listener production.
I figured out why you always sound so much better than me when we're singing, because let's be honest, neither of us are bad singers, but neither of us are great singers.
Mm.
And whenever we sing on the podcast, you sound amazing. And I was listening back to an episode the other week, and it's because you always take things like three octaves lower than it's meant to be, you cheater. And I always just go for it. I just like aim for the big notes. I'm like, let's do it all out, or just go hard or go home. And then I listen to you, and what was the song I made you sing? Rain on My Parade,
yeah.
Which is like a pretty high octave, and you come in with, don't tell me not to fly, I've simply got to. If someone takes a spill, it's me and not you. Anyone sounds good singing things three octaves lower.
I gotta play with the advantages I've been dealt here, honey.
I want a sing-off in future where we both sing the notes as they are designed. Then we'll see who sounds terrible.
I reserve the right to put the music in whatever key, whatever arrangement suits me best.
Then so do I.
It's the quality of the product. You sing in whatever key you want.
Well, yeah, but I try to stay true to the notes and then I sound terrible. And all this is my roundabout way of saying I'm not a good singer and I wish I was.
Aww. I know the truth. I know that you do have a very, very good voice. It's just we never get on here and like warm up or practice or anything. It's always just coming in cold.
That's very true. That's very true, Jacob. Speaking of beautiful voices and taking things down a few
and
octaves. Ha 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 ha. Everyone sounds good. See, I can sound good. I can sound good when I take things down a few octaves. Take it away, my dulcet-toned Adonis.
Oh, this is such a weird little bee in your bonnet that you've got all of a sudden.
Start the show, please.
Everyone, and welcome back for another episode of Just the Gist, a weekly-ish podcast where Rosie Waterland and I, Jacob Stanley, give you just the gist of what you need to know about a topic we think you'll find interesting enough to bring up at a dinner party. Hello, Rosie.
Oh, Jacob, my love, how are you?
Wonderful, thank you very much.
Looking particularly tanned and sun-kissed and blonde. I keep saying as your hair gets lighter, your skin gets darker.
Yeah, the contrast just builds up and up.
You are getting so tanned, it's getting to the point of cultural appropriation. So you better watch the F out. All right? You're getting there.
It's unintentional. I don't have control over this, I got to tell you. My eyebrows have completely bleached. Can you see?
Oh, yeah. I can't even see them.
Mm-hmm. That's why
I, on the other hand, drew mine in this morning. Darling, it's your turn to tell me a story today, which is why I'm extra relaxed.
Yeah, yeah.
What are you talking about today?
This week I'm serving you a story about a man and a woman called Ron and Joy Holiday, and perfect timing. Thank goodness Carol Baskin is in the headlines again, reminding everyone of what a phenomenon Tiger King was. Long before Tiger King and even before Siegfried and Roy were a thing or had even met, there was Ron and Joy Holiday, and there were a couple of world-famous dancers who set up one of the world's first ever big cat shows. And this story has everything. It's got a very intriguing love triangle. There are tigers and leopards and jaguars, and there are rhinestones and spandex and sequins and perms. And it's
everything
set in
you
Florida.
Love.
Oh, it's such a fantastic story. But of course,
set in Florida.
All ends in tragedy, and there is only one survivor that makes it out of this story alive.
Is it one of the animals?
You'll find out at the end of the tale. I'm going to keep you in suspense.
Okay, well, before your skin gets any browner, shall we cut to breaking news, breaking news. I got the scoop, see? X-ray, X-ray, read all about it. Breaking news. So, hot off the presses, it just happened this morning. Moira Rose got her Emmy. Yes!
And if that's not a cause for alcohol, I don't know what is.
Ah, Schitt's Creek swept the Emmys in a record history-making way. So this morning, Schitt's Creek won Best Comedy, Best Writing, Best Directing, Best Actor for Eugene Levy, Best Actress for Catherine O'Hara.
No.
Best Supporting Actor for Daniel Levy and Best Supporting Actress for Annie Murphy, which is the first time in the history of any show, drama or comedy, no show ever at the Emmys has ever won all seven of that category.
Wow.
It's like, it's nuts. And to think that Schitt's Creek was completely ignored for its first four seasons, never got nominated for anything. No one even heard of it. In its fifth season, people were like, oh my God, this show is amazing. So then last year it got nominated for everything, but it went up against Fleabag, which just, you know, killed it last year and won everything. And so now in its sixth final season, it finally is getting the awards, the attention, the accolades it deserves. Moira Rose finally got her baby Emmy.
Yes, I'm so happy for her. When one of us shines, all of us shines. And they all are shining. So good. I'm so thrilled for them. And, I mean, we get so many messages from people saying, thank you so much for recommending Schitt's Creek and bringing it into my life. Pay that forward. Make sure that everyone that you speak to makes the time to watch it and pushes through the first few episodes. I understand why some people start off and go, this isn't really for me. Push through. It is the best show of all time.
I think often with little quirky comedies like that, the first few eps, they always take a few eps to sort of find their feet. It was the same with Community. That show took a few eps to find its feet and then just became the best show ever. So if you haven't watched Schitt's Creek, watch it. There's a reason it just won every possible Emmy award. Oh, and one that I kept in mind for you was the Creative Arts Emmys, which are all the extra awards, happened a few days earlier. And it also won Best Costume Design, obviously, because Moira Rose's costumes are just out of this world amazing.
Yeah.
So phenomenal. much deserved.
They deserved it purely for her wedding celebrant efficient outfit, papal inspired.
I know.
Oh.
But every wig, every just chef's kiss, chef's kiss, chef's kiss. Best show ever.
Mm-hmm.
Next up, we've got some Elizabeth Holmes updates.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
What's she up to?
So our fave medical scammer / weird voice pretender. If you haven't listened to our episode on Elizabeth Holmes, you should go back. A lot of people still say it's one of their favorites. One of the earliest ones we did, I think.
It's a cracker.
So she was meant to have her court case this year, but obviously things have been delayed because of COVID. But last week it came up, there was a hearing in court because, hold on, I've written it down here because it's legal words. Her lawyer had asked to introduce evidence of mental disease or defect or other mental conditions bearing on the issue of guilt. So basically her lawyer asked, can we please submit evidence saying that she's a nutter? Like basically using mental health as a defense or reason for why she did what she did. They said they would like to use testimony from a clinical psychologist who they've hired, and that particular psychologist focuses on trauma, violence against women, often provides expert testimony in cases involving interpersonal violence. So people are saying she might be gearing up to turn on Sunny, her partner, in the whole thing.
Oh.
And maybe say that, like, because that's the only reason you would hire this specific doctor.
Right.
But the funny thing is, so the lawyer put in this thing saying, we would like to have this psychologist interview and Elizabeth and then submit the testimony. And then the court said, well, okay, fine, but you can't just pick your own doctor. So we also will have to get some prosecutors, doctors to interview her as well. And Elizabeth Holmes and her team were like, no, just our doctor, just our one special doctor. And the judge was like, no, you can't just buy a doctor off and get them to say whatever you want. Like, this needs to be, you know, an objective thing where a few doctors from different places talk to you so they can come to a fair conclusion, not just one that, you know, you've paid a doctor for. And so they were really pissed off about that. But then also the judge said each of the interviews have to be videotaped, which they really argued against. And the judge was like, no, I don't want any messing around. I want you to be interviewed by a doctor on your side and a doctor on their side, and all of it has to be taped.
Uh-huh.
And what I wouldn't give to see tapes of Elizabeth Holmes being interviewed by psychologists. Oh, my God.
Is there any chance it will be released to the public? Is this one of those things that goes on public record?
I have no idea. It depends on the case, I guess.
I think it depends on the state as well that she's being tried in. They've each got different rules. Wow, yeah.
I know. So, yes, thanks. But still, I can't believe that she's now clearly coming out trying to say, oh, I was mentally unwell. And that's why I did this.
Yeah.
Like, please. You're just a scammer. Being a scammer isn't a mental illness.
Feels desperate. She's clutching. Mm-mm. Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, nothing's ever going to happen to her. She's engaged to a billionaire now. So they're taking care of her and she'll be fine. Oh, also, you'll love this one and I'm sure you heard about it. News came out this week that Madonna is writing and directing her own biopic.
I did not hear this, but that's so exciting.
I know.
Shut up.
Oh. Yeah, she's like, I'm doing it myself. So
yes.
I know. A lot of people were making fun of her, but then a lot of people were saying, well, how is it any different to writing your own autobiography? And I've written two. So, I mean, you know. She wants control. And she's co-writing it with Diablo Cody, who's the woman who wrote Juno.
Oh.
So I guess someone delicately on her team suggested to her that she may need some help writing the actual thing, but she's directing it herself. So that's happening.
Wow, what could possibly go wrong? She's got such an impeccable track record when it comes to her movie roles.
Hey, look, I didn't hate the movie about Wallace Simpson that she directed. I actually really quite liked that movie.
Oh. Did she direct that? I thought that was Guy Ritchie.
No, she directed that. Oh. Madonna directed that.
Okay.
So, like, that was not bad.
Mm. But, you know, for every Wallace Simpson, you've got her swept away.
That's true. Well, we'll see. We'll see. I'm excited. It's going to be like her... You know, Marc Jacobs by Marc Jacobs, inspired by Marc Jacobs for Marc Jacobs at markjacobs.com. You know, it's going to be her thing. I'm psyched. I'm pumped.
And whether it's good or bad, it's just going to be so fabulous. And I can't wait.
Mm-hmm.
Do we have any clue who's going to play her?
The main name that has been tossed around, and I think it probably will end up being this person, is a young actress called Julie Garner. She's in. She's been in a few things. Probably the most famous is... Whatchamajig, Ozark. She's the blonde. Do you watch it?
No.
Oh, well, no, she's in that. You have no clue about it. Why am I even trying to explain to you who a pop cultural person is? Anyway, Julie Garner. If you Google her, you'll see it and you'll be like, she looks very 80s Madonna. Like, so she'd be perfect for the younger years at least.
Oh, yes. Yeah. She's got the hair. She's got the eyebrows.
Yeah.
Yes.
She's perfect. And she is a great actress. Actually, a role that she did play that you should watch is the... You know how I told you a few weeks ago that there was a drama TV series of Dirty John starring Eric Bana as Dirty John? So she plays the daughter that he tries to stab in that.
Ah.
So she's in that.
Okay.
And she's excellent. One more thing before you tell me about your... I've heard that since you've become an expert diver, you now have some great seasickness vomiting stories. So we're going to get to that. But this final little bit of breaking news is that Carol Baskin, our lovely favourite, hey, are you cool cats and kittens, she did her first debut dance on the US Dancing with the Stars. And, of course, she did it to Eye of the Tiger. And, of course, she was terrible. But the best part about it is the family of the husband who people think she murdered paid to have an ad play right before her dance asking if anybody has any information about missing, possibly murdered husband man.
Mm-hmm.
It was the best.
Yeah. It was such a clever move on their part
so
to just
smart.
Remind everybody this is a murder suspect that you're reveling in watching do the paso doble in leopard print. And apparently they have actually had some really good leads come forward.
Yeah, I heard that too.
Mm.
And then they asked Carol Baskin about it and she kind of was like all self-righteous. She was like, look, I think it was just a publicity stunt, but, you know, if it leads to people realising what really happened to him, then I'm happy. And it's like, are you though?
Mm. Yeah.
Because you killed him, didn't you, Carol? Allegedly. Allegedly.
Allegedly. Did you hear she also has been given her own TV show?
No.
Yeah, so this was just announced yesterday because they've realised that her name guarantees ratings gold. She is getting her own dedicated TV series about her and her husband, I think it's Howard, going and shutting down.
He barely has a name.
Yeah.
She barely lets him speak.
They will be going around the country and it's basically just tracking their campaigns to shut down the big cat entertainment businesses all around the US.
But they own a big cat entertainment business.
Yeah, but, you know, they see theirs
That's
as being
the
quite
the irony
different.
Of it.
Yeah.
Is it, though? They're all in cages.
Yeah. Well, I think the big irony of this is that, you know, she signed up for Tiger King thinking that she was going to be the heroine of that story.
Yeah,
she
I know.
Thought that she was going to be the protagonist, not the antagonist. And
but that's narcissistic people and particularly, like, sociopaths always think that.
Mm-hmm.
They always think that. So I just, but particularly narcissists, like when I used to write about The Bachelor, so many people would say, it was the number one question I got, why do people keep signing up to be on this show when they see how badly it goes for everyone else before them? And I would say, because everybody thinks that they're inherently likable.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody looks at people who get made the villain in the years before and go, oh, well, that could never happen to me because I'm charming and amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And then they're shocked when it happens to them. It's narcissism. Because, I mean, it takes a certain level of narcissism to agree to go on a show like that. And I think it's that narcissism that stops you from ever even considering the possibility that you would get a less than stellar, charismatic, likable edit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, there you go.
Oh, and that is such a fantastic prelude to me getting into telling you a story about some narcissistic, big cat loving people. But
excuse me, do you want to tell me about the VOM?
I started telling Rosie this before we actually started recording and she said, wait till you get on air. It's kind of
said,
gross.
This deserves a larger... As soon as I heard the word vomit, I was like, this deserves a larger audience. Say it on air.
Oh, I got
tell
to...
Tell us.
Live and experience one of the final scenes from Drop Dead Gorgeous, you know, the one where all the beauty queens are vomiting all over the place and someone yells out, someone call an ambulance, forget an ambulance, call a priest. I went out to do my advanced open water diving course and the seas were very, very, very rough and there were only like 12, 14 passengers on the boat. But it only took one of them to start hurling before then all of them started hurling and they were running on a skeleton crew because they had such few passengers on board and I was one of the very few people who was still well enough to then help these poor people hold their sweaty hands and try to get them out to the back of the boat so that they could hurl over the side of the boat or into a bag. And I'm not good with vomiting at all, the noises, the smells, any of it, but it was just one of those
situations. And how long did you have to go on the trip when this started?
It's a 90-minute boat trip and it started
and you would
probably at like minute number 10.
Oh, no. Oh, God. Yeah. And I will say, as someone who gets very seasick, like I am not good on the water, it is the worst possible feeling because it's not like a car. Even if you get car sick, you can pull over. You know what I mean? And the horror and the awful feeling can stop. But when you're on a boat, you're just stuck on it and there's nothing you can do to make you feel better. And it honestly, it's one of those things where you're like, maybe I should just jump over the side and die.
Yeah.
Like that's how awful it is. It is awful. I can't even imagine.
Oh, yeah. People were getting very, very desperate, saying things like, can you just pull over and leave me at one of the islands on the way there and then pick me up on the way back, or please turn the boat around? Like, it just looked like it was such incredibly terrible torture. But then, come lunchtime, all of those people had very, very full plates of food and they scoffed all
stupid.
Of it. Forgetting about the fact that we had to go back the way that we had come under the same conditions. Yes.
Was there vomit on the seas part two?
But I was not helping for round two. I'm sorry.
But with more food.
Correct.
Because they just had, oh, idiots.
Yeah. And think like deli meats and cheeses.
God, swallow some Dramamine. God, get it together.
Yeah. So, I mean, that was a low light, but also a funny little moment of my
I love that you know that in your new expert diving lifestyle, that is the only part of that I'd be interested in, is really funny stories where there's disastrous vomiting.
It was apocalyptic. To-dos. It was horrific. Yeah.
Ah, gorgeous. Love it. Beautiful. Mm. All right. Shall we get to the proper story? Here's where I can chill. I can relax. I got my Polly Pockets behind me and some vintage boats and radios, but I've still got to do something about that. But let's go.
Give it time. All right. This isn't my best work, but I'm calling this one Fangs for the Memories, the dramatic
Fangs
story
for the
of the cat dancers.
That's a pretty good one.
Thank you. So, like I said, this is the story of a couple called Ron and Joy Holiday. Mm-hmm. Joy's name originally was Doris, and she and Ron grew up in a really small town in Maine, and they were friends when they were kids. They met each other at ballet classes. He was 11, she was 7, but despite the age difference, they bonded over the fact that they were both real outcasts, because he was a very artistic type, which is code for flaming queen at a young age.
Yes.
And she was a very, very awkward dweeb. She had a lazy eye and she had really frizzy hair. And so they were both picked on a lot, but they found each other and they just united over their love of dance and their dream to go on to become professional dancers. They couldn't wait till they could escape this small town and go and take on the world.
Isn't that just the dream of every queen and his fag hag?
Absolutely. It is that classic symbiotic hag / fag bangle relationship where they were both benefiting from it. They both needed each other. There was no romantic connection whatsoever to begin with. They were just best friends and, if anything, more like family. But Ron, of course, graduated a few years ahead of Joy and he fulfilled his dream by moving straight to New York the second he finished with everything at high school. Left Joy back home, but they did stay very good friends. They were in contact just via letters that they were writing each other until the day.
Wait, what year is this? Sorry.
This is in the 50s, late 50s.
When he graduates.
Yeah, yeah. So he was born in like 36. She was born in 39. So while they were at school, they were going through the World War and America was recovering from the Depression, etc. But things were starting to sort of boom in the 1950s and Hollywood was really reaching its heyday.
Yeah.
Finally, the day came when Doris was able to move to New York herself and she had completely transformed. So in his mind, Ron had remembered this really dorky girl who was constantly getting picked on because of her glasses and her hair. He used to get in fights all the time because he would come to her defense when her bullies would be picking on her. So he really felt like he was her sort of older brother and protector. And then all of a sudden she turned up in New York and she had platinum blonde hair and she'd lost a lot of weight and she had just evolved into this total bombshell butterfly, absolutely a glow up. And he was smitten. He told her he'd always just thought of her as his sister, but baba booey, things are different now.
Did you just say baba booey?
Baba booey.
Baba booey. Baba booey.
Oh, I saw Maya Rudolph won the Emmy as well for
she did.
Big Mouth.
for playing... did she win for Big Mouth? She also won for playing Kamala Harris.
Oh, really? Yeah.
On SNL, yeah.
I only saw the Big Mouth one because I follow Big Mouth on Instagram.
Bubble boy. Bubble boy.
Anyway, so he started to feel a stirring in his crotch and decided that he was going to make his move, and he got Doris drunk and he seduced her, and they decided that they were going to move in together in New York, which of course instantly meant they were going to have to get married because they were both raised to be very, very Catholic. Doris had actually been considering potentially becoming a nun rather than becoming a dancer in the future. So
he's, I mean, he's bisexual then.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, but only for hot girls, obviously.
That's right. Yes.
What an asshole. Okay.
He's got a thing for skinny blondes.
Yeah. Oh, what man doesn't?
Yeah. he, of course, designed their wedding gown and they had a beautiful ceremony. Oh, and then
heaven.
They started their life together in New York. And this was the moment when Doris Gagnon rebranded herself as Joy Holiday.
Can I interject here and say, do you know whose relationship this reminds me exactly of?
Who?
Fran Drescher and her husband.
Oh.
So they grew up together in Queens. I don't think they were they were Jewish. They were Jewish, obviously. They were high school sweethearts. They dated for a long time. And she says in hindsight, it was always so obvious that he was gay. And it was that exact same thing. He picked her outfits. And when they got married, he like picked her dress and did all that kind of stuff. And then they created the nanny together. And he was like this creative kind of soulmate to her. And then he came out as gay, I think, either just before the nanny started filming or during nanny filming. And so, like, they got divorced and he ended up with a partner and with a male partner, and they went on to be best friends. But she was like, at the time, we were so young and it was so unthinkable. Like, if you found someone you loved, you were meant to marry them. That's just what the thing was. And we were deeply in love. And she goes, I think just at the time, there wasn't enough information, or no one knew what being gay meant or what it was, and no one really talked about it, particularly in religious families. And so they just figured, well, we're in love, so this must be what love is. And they got married. But she's like, if we had been best friends today, we would have understood that our love was a different kind of love. But they had no idea back then.
Yeah. I mean, these guys were a little bit clued in because from the very beginning they had an agreement that neither of them owned the other one, and they were very happy for each other to have other lovers if and when they needed it. They felt like their bond and their relationship was special enough that having sex with other people really didn't matter at all. But they did, you know, they were genuinely attracted to each other as well, and they did have a physical relationship. Anyway, they went ahead and started trying to build their career, and they were very determined because they had a lot to prove to everyone back home. They were these little farm kids from Maine, raised poor, and they wanted to show all the people who had bullied them and put them down just how successful they could become.
Look at us now.
Yeah. And it didn't happen immediately. They kept auditioning for roles and kept getting knocked back. The only way that they could make ends meet was to pose for, inverted commas, muscle magazines. Wink. Until they finally got their big break starring in a show at Radio City Music Hall. And immediately...
Oh, that's a big deal.
Yeah, huge deal. Like, massive step up. And they got rave reviews straight away. And within the space of just a few months, they were the king and queen of Broadway. They were recognized as the very best adagio dancers in the world. Adagio is like an incredibly difficult combination of ballet and acrobatics. It requires incredible strength and agility. And what they were doing was just mind-boggling. Very sort of Cirque du Soleil before Cirque du Soleil. And so...
Yeah, I was going to say, that's Cirque du Soleil, right?
Totally, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, every major celebrity wanted to have Ron and Joy Holiday dancing on stage with them. So they danced with Cher, they danced with Liza, they danced with Julie Andrews. They were constantly going on TV, on the Johnny Carson show and morning TV shows. It even reached the point where Jackie Kennedy invited them to come and perform at the White House for her and JFK in a private performance.
Why are we doing a podcast and not that, which is clearly our dream life?
I know. Well, it'd be very, very physically strenuous.
Yeah. Ah, yes, talent.
Yeah, they've got a level of determination and discipline we do not.
No.
Yeah, so massively successful. They were touring all around the world and enjoying the celebrity lifestyle and enjoying the open marriage that they were having as well. Ron almost had a brief fling with Siegfried before he met Roy, but he ended up turning Siegfried down, saying, no, he's not my type, he's too femme, which I have to say is very rich coming from a man who has his eyeliner literally tattooed on.
oh, my mum does that too.
And you should see the wigs that he wears as well, and the way that he speaks. Every time he opens his mouth, a sequin jock strap falls out. But they kept, like, just going, becoming more and more and more successful. As they went, the shows became more elaborate, the costumes became more flamboyant, because they had to keep upping the ante. These were two people who were very sort of damaged deep down, and so no level of success was ever going to be enough for them. Yes, they had achieved their goal.
A bit,
they
were
successful.
It's a bit Liberace-esque.
Yeah.
Yeah. Reminds me of Liberace.
I don't know very much about Liberace. I would definitely say in terms of the costuming and the opulence and people just ignoring the fact that someone is so clearly a raging homosexual, that I would draw the parallel there. But if you're seeing any other parallels in the narrative.
Well, yeah, because he just kept topping and topping and topping his glamour and ridiculousness. And he was, on the inside, incredibly mentally damaged. And, I mean, it was almost like the excess on the outside represented the lack of self-worth on the inside.
Mm. Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Nothing will ever be enough for them to actually feel satisfied and comfortable with themselves.
Yeah.
And so this is now where the big cats become involved in the show. So they met an actor called William Holden when they were doing another show at Radio City. He was a really big deal in the 50s and the 60s, very, very famous actor. And when they were performing together, he was telling them backstage about this animal sanctuary that he had just set up in Kenya. And Ron told William all about his dream of one day having a real live big cat in their shows, because they had started doing these numbers where Joy would be dressed up as a cat and dancing like a cat, but Ron really wanted the real thing. And William
obviously
loved the idea. He thought that would be absolutely spectacular. And so he surprised them with a black leopard, a panther that he brought over from Kenya. They called it Aladdin, and he came to live with them in their house in Jersey. They had absolutely no idea what they were doing. They messed up big time. They were feeding him tinned cat food, and they let him sleep in their bed, and they made every single mistake that they could possibly make trying to figure out how to raise this cat. And then William was like, maybe you should look at a book. And so they decided to get out every single resource that they could find to read up on becoming an animal trainer, and they became self-taught jaguar tamers.
And what year does this bring us to? What year are we in? Is this the 60s now?
This is in the 60s, yes.
Okay.
Yeah. So it took them a good year and a half to train Aladdin well enough that they could actually incorporate him into the show, and the crowd absolutely loved it. No one had seen anything like this before. And so they were drawing quite big audiences. Everyone was clueless, though, about just how dangerous it really was, because this leopard could very easily have killed a fully grown human.
Yeah, I was going to ask, like, what do they do? Does he just come out on a DeMonte leash, or, like, is he...
Yeah.
Tell me.
Literally on a leash that would probably be flimsier than the harness that you were using to walk Boo around Adelaide.
Yeah. Oh, my God, no.
Yeah.
And did he just, like, walk... Did he have to jump through a hoop of fire or something, or what? Did he just...
Along those lines, they didn't actually do the fire thing, but yes, lots of jumping and lots of, oh, look, he'll let me lie on top of him and then he'll lie on top of me, and just really showing people the fact that they had sort of tamed this
tamed
wild beast.
It. Yeah.
Incredibly dangerous. Things could have gone worse than they actually did, but of course things did from time to time go wrong. One time, surprise, surprise, Aladdin did attack Joy, cut her up pretty badly on her scalp and on her arm. And they,
oh my God.
Anytime that they were hurt by him, they refused to go to the hospital because they thought that there was a risk that they might take Aladdin away from them. So they would just sort of patch themselves up. And each time they just kept telling each other and telling themselves, this was a silly mishap. It was just an accident. It'll never happen again. There was one time when Joy literally blamed herself for one of the attacks by saying, well, I was on my period.
Are you joking?
No, I'm not.
What?
So they just kept rationalizing
to me. Why did she get her period? Oh my God, someone said it for real.
For real. She genuinely believed the only reason that Aladdin had attacked her was because she was in heat.
Wait. Right, so yeah, I was going to say, so not because she was on her period, so her temperament was different, it's because he could smell her menstrual blood. Is
correct.
That?
Yes.
mm-hmm. By the way, just as an aside, I always wondered about that in Twilight. Like, would the vampires like Edward and stuff go extra crazy when Bella had her period? Like, they never really talked about the mechanics of that. But you assume, no, but I'm sorry, is it not like quite, it stands to reason that that would be a problematic time of month for vampires?
Yeah, okay, yeah, yeah.
Anyway,
I actually don't know anything about Twilight, so I don't know.
Who could believe there's a plot hole in the masterpiece that is Twilight? Continue.
All right. So they just kept finding ways to rationalize what they were doing because they knew that this cat and future cats would be the key to ongoing success for them because they knew they had to rely on this new gimmick that they'd found because they were getting old, their bodies were getting tired, they were in their mid-30s by now, they couldn't keep doing the adagio dancing that they had been doing previously.
They're not getting old.
In dancing
when
years...
When you just said that, I imagine them in their 50s, like in dancing, for dancing.
Yes.
They're getting towards the end of the most physical part of their career.
Yes.
Shall we word it that way? Thank you very much.
Fair enough. Yes. Coming towards the end of their life cycle as dancers, so they needed this cat gimmick. So they decided they were going to get really serious about training Aladdin and they decided to move from their little house in New Jersey to Florida so that then he could actually live outside as opposed to in their basement. And off they went to Florida.
The world's toilet.
Where they set up the Cat Ranchers dance. And this really sort of put them at the vanguard of the exotic animal performance genre. So very few people were doing anything like this anywhere. So they were being invited to tour all around the world. They went all around the globe at least 5 times. And they started in venues like casinos, in nightclubs, but then they kept growing and growing so that then they were performing in really huge theaters and they were being invited to come and perform private shows for royalty. And as the show evolved, it was less about the dancing and more about the magic tricks. So they really sort of inspired a lot of what Siegfried and Roy ended up doing.
Interesting.
And they started collecting more and more and more cats, leopards, and jaguars. And then they progressed on to tigers and they gave them names like Venus and Adonis and Hercules and Diva. And they're
all names that either of us would be happy to have.
100%, yes. I especially love Sugar Bear, actually. That was a good one.
I'll be Sugar Bear and you'll be Adonis.
So their hubris became really, really massive. They had this grand vision of what their lives could be and they were just totally blinded to any of the potential risks and dangers and consequences that could affect them or other people. They didn't use even fences in their shows. So they were using those flimsy leashes to control these animals, which are highly evolved predators that can weigh up to 300 kilograms. They're at the top of the food chain. But because they just saw these cats as being their children, they shared their living spaces with them when they were all at home together. They just had this arrogant confidence in their own abilities to control mm-hmm. and influence the way that these cats behaved.
And someone's going to eat a little kid.
Mm-hmm, we'll see.
Yeah. There's going to be a big cat got my baby happening soon.
No matter what would go wrong, it just wouldn't stop them. One of the worst things mm. that happened that you would think would get them to pause and reconsider the choices that they're making is one time one of the Jaguars was about to attack an audience member and Ron intervened and the Jaguar bit him all the way through his wrist and his blood loss was so severe that he had to be put in a coma for 2 weeks in hospital and they almost had to amputate
what?
His arm. Yeah. But when he got out, they still insisted these animals are perfectly tame. This was just a small mishap and they got back on with the show.
You know what they said? Joy had her period. That is ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
That is... It's like in Tiger King when the tiger bit off that man's arm and then he just went back to work there.
Yep.
And was like, oh, I shouldn't have put my arm in the cage and here I am with no arm,
mm-hmm.
but it was my fault.
Yep. I mean, years and years later, Siegfried and Roy famously were attacked by one of their lions on stage, dragged one of them off by his neck and he barely survived. But then he chose to go on and perform with that same lion again in the future.
But the thing is, it's okay, here's where it gets me because it's like, it's not the animal's fault. They are wild animals and they live on instinct and they attack on instinct, so you cannot blame them. So I do get the impulse to say, it's not them, I did something wrong, I did something to provoke them. Fine, yes, that's probably true. But once they've done that, you should say, maybe I shouldn't force them into this lifestyle anymore then and maybe we should stop this altogether. It's the fact that they keep going after that. Yep. Is nuts.
Yeah. Their philosophy was that they would just keep learning from their mistakes and keep getting better and better and better. And like they were living the high life. They were really, really successful and famous. They weren't about to give that up. And the show had actually now by this stage reached a point where they knew the only way that they could continue to grow and they wanted to continue to grow was if they brought on additional members in the act because they needed more than two people on stage controlling the cats. And so they started auditioning people to come and join the cat dancers and they turned down pretty much everyone because it turns out people who are attracted to working with cats usually have a drug habit of some sort. So
I was going to say a total weirdos, but yes, all right.
Oh, yeah, yeah. They were getting a lot of Fruit Loops and a lot of people who were just high out of their mind. So they gave up on the idea for a while and then Joy came across this guy called Chuck Lizza when they were on tour in Maryland one summer. And Chuck Lizza. Mm-hmm. He was a zoology major, he was a musician and he managed a circus that Ron and Joy went to visit. And it was kind of love at first sight in a way. He was super, super, super cute and he was about 30 years younger than Ron and Joy. And like them, he was a very damaged soul. He was estranged from his family and they sort of took him under their wing and offered him a job, which was a dream come true for him. They told him they were going to move him down to Florida and he was going to live in their house and he was going to help them train the animals and he became a stagehand for the show and he'd clean out all of their cages.
If they're 30 years older than him, how old are they now? What era are we in now? Are we in like the 80s now or something?
We are, yeah. Late 80s and then this starts to get into the early 90s, this part.
I honestly don't imagine Florida in any time period other than the 80s or early 90s.
Yeah, it hasn't progressed
that much. I don't think it exists outside of that time. Yeah, exactly. Okay. So they got a little toy boy.
They did, yes. And it's really weird. You'll hear about this in a moment, but they would tell everyone that they considered him a son and they loved him like a son and he was the son that they'd never had.
Yeah.
He finally agreed to start going on stage and being the MC for the shows. And then bit by bit, Ron tried to convince him to actually become a part of the show. And the only concern that Chuck had was not the fact that the animals could very easily lash out and kill him. He was just concerned about the idea of having to wear tights. So his one condition was, as long as I don't have to wear the sorts of outfits that you are wearing, Ron. And I promise I'm going to post some photos of the types of outfits that Ron and Joy were wearing so that you can understand why that was a big deterrent for Mr. Chuck Lizer. But he agreed. He started performing with them and their life became just incredibly harmonious and joyful. Ron designed all the costumes and Joy did all the choreography and Chuck wrote all of the music and they trained all of the cats together. They only ever used positive reinforcement to train the cats. They used rewards. They never used punishment like whips or prods or anything like that. They just used love and affection to influence what the animals did. But, I mean, I think you would agree with me here. This is all just animal abuse. You're doing it in a way that's not as bad as beating the animal, but at the end of the day, you are forcing these animals to do unnatural behaviours in environments that would surely be torture for them because they had strobe lights and smoke bombs and so much loud noise going on, and these animals were just tortured prisoners.
Well, it's like that scene in Blackfish, that documentary about the orcas at SeaWorld, and they were doing this right before Tillicum kills one of the most famous, you know, like orca diver trainer people. He gets confused because they're doing this like training exercise where when he doesn't, where he does a trick right, he gets a fish. And if he doesn't do a trick right, he doesn't get a fish. But when he doesn't get the fish, he gets really frustrated and upset and it confuses him. And then he did a trick right, but the trainer wasn't looking. And so she didn't give him the fish. And so then when he did the trick right and he didn't get the fish, he started freaking out because it messes with their heads.
Yeah.
And, you know, 2 minutes later, he pulled her into the water and bit her arm off. Like, you can't blame them. It's animal abuse messing with their heads like that. It's mean.
Yeah. And obviously they were telling themselves the exact opposite, that they were doing nothing but loving these animals that love them back unconditionally. But I think today we are far more aware of how bad these sorts of shows are. Anyway, so Chuck kind of became the face of the cat dancers because he was the youngest, he was the prettiest, he didn't have creepy eyeliner tattoo and he didn't wear a wig, so he would be the one that would appear on TV mostly because they were getting a lot of publicity for what they were doing. While he was great as a talking head for the group, he was nowhere near as good or confident a trainer as Ron or Joy. He had a lot of different incidents. Sometimes those incidents even happened on camera, but even still, it wasn't enough of a reason for him to stop doing what he was doing. He believed that he could just keep getting better with time. Everyone was scratching their heads and wondering, what's going on with this couple here living together, traveling the world together? A lot of people just assumed that Chuck was Joy's lover because Ron was, you know, pretty unashamedly flamboyant.
And probably hooking up with dudes all the time.
Oh, yeah. Some people did guess correctly that, in fact, they were a trio. They were
I was going to say, thruple.
Yeah. It was.
This is so Tiger King-esque.
I know.
I can't even.
I know. It's fully like these guys inspired this. They had a really, really tight bond, which, unlike Tiger King, was not meth-fueled. They genuinely had a deep connection with each other.
Yeah.
They didn't have an official wedding ceremony. They just did something between the three of them. When they were in private, they would wear a necklace that had a charm on it that was three wedding rings that were all bound together.
Oh, so they're clearly a throuple then.
Like absolutely.
They're a throuple.
Yeah. Okay. They were committed to each other, but they never announced it publicly. They kept it hidden from everyone. Even though they were madly in love, they just called Chuck their friend. And behind the scenes, it does actually really sound like an idyllic, functional relationship. No one was putting any pressure on anyone else. They all got their space when they needed it. They each had their own separate bedroom. And like I said, it was all very unconventional because they treated Chuck like he was their son, but then he was also a lover and a member of the throuple.
Yes.
But they considered themselves this family unit, and they were the co-parents of their magical, magnificent children, the cats. And so life was good for them for a while, and it could have just sustained that way. But in 1995, Ron made the decision that they needed to get themselves a white tiger because...
Ron.
Mm-hmm. Back in the day, white supremacy in the big cat shows was a very, very real thing, and it still kind of is today. White tigers are super rare, so a lot of people will pay good money to go and see a white tiger. And at this point, 1995, all these different producers and directors and promoters were saying to Ron, you've got to get a white tiger because Siegfried and Roy are the biggest
Siegfried,
act
yeah, I was
going to
say, isn't that
right
what
now.
They always yeah. used? Yeah. Yeah.
They had two white tigers and a white lion. And so they were the biggest act in Vegas, but they were stuck in Vegas. And so this was the cat dancers' opportunity to pick up every other job around the US and around the world if they could just get themselves a white tiger. And like I said, it was a huge attraction because of the fact that the last wild white tiger was shot and killed in 1958. And it's a very, very rare genetic mutation that can make a tiger white. It's only 1 in 10,000 chance that the tiger is going to be born with white fur, yes, in the wild. But in captivity, there are more and more white tigers because of inbreeding, yes.
Okay.
Yeah. And bad inbreeding as well. It all stems back to one particular individual. And the sorts of inbreeding that they will do will be one... male will breed with his own mother, and then they'll force him to breed with one of the daughters that comes out of that litter, so his sister daughter. And then when she gives birth, he'll force him to breed with her offspring, which means that he's breeding with his daughter, sister, granddaughter.
It's so they're like the royal family of the animal world. Yeah.
Gotcha. And, you know, it's very, very inhumane. A lot of these animals are born with a lot of deformities. A lot of them have to be euthanized. It's cruel. And it also means that the animals can be very, very unpredictable and especially violent and dangerous. So Chuck and Joy were saying, no, absolutely not. We cannot get a white tiger. We can pretty much guarantee that it's going to be inbred. But Ron was really feeling the pressure from all the people who were booking his gigs. And so he kept searching until he could find a seller who claimed that they had a white tiger that was not the result of inbreeding. It was just...
But no matter what, you're going to be getting like a Dr. Frankenstein's monster kind of tiger. Yeah. Like, oh God, yuck. Okay.
But he decided to jump on the opportunity and he... really pushed to convince Chuck to agree, and then he really, really pushed to convince Joy to agree to getting this white tiger. Mm. Finally, they came around. They dropped $50,000 on buying Jupiter, along with his brother, Shercon, which was just a normal orange tiger. And they got him home when he was very, very young, and as kittens do, he imprinted on one of them and he chose Chuck to be his father. He would always go to Chuck, and so Chuck took the main responsibility in raising him, even though Chuck was by far the least experienced of the three when it came to raising these animals. Shercon was a totally placid, normal tiger, but Jupiter from the very beginning was a total brat. Like, he knew that he was special. He had a whole lot of white privilege going on. He was very, very stubborn, very difficult. Yeah. They called him Mr. Perfect because he was just super arrogant and refused to follow directions. But they were determined that they were going to find a way to get him on stage because they had designed new costumes. They had a totally new act, and they knew that they could get to a totally new level of success by incorporating
Jupiter
into their
act. Well, yeah, and money's depending on it now. Like, they've invested a lot of money in it, so they need it to work.
Absolutely.
To pay off.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And for a few years, everything was going pretty much swimmingly. Jupiter was difficult but not impossible, and they were making a whole lot of money. But then in October of 1998, catastrophe struck.
Oh, no. 1998. Gosh, that's not that long ago.
No, not at all.
I can't believe I haven't heard of this.
Yeah. I'll tell you where you can watch some cool documentaries at the end of this as well. It's kind of been hidden. I guess the story was big at a time when, you know, social media wasn't so huge and few of us were on the internet back then. Anyway, one morning, Jupiter was being particularly difficult for Ron. Ron was trying to move him from his night kennel to his day kennel early in the morning. And Jupiter had already been a bit spooked for a few days because there was construction going on to expand the compound near where he would sleep. And so he sort of got halfway from kennel A to kennel B and he just lay down and refused to move. And at this point, he weighed 270 kilos. So there was really nothing that Ron could do to convince him to move. So he yelled out, "Joy, can you please...
Hey, look, I've been drunk at 2 a.m. and you've been with me where I have laid down. Middle of the street, public bathroom, corner of a club, who cares? And I refuse to move. So Jupiter, I get it. I get it, buddy. Sometimes you're over it and that's it."
This was his peaceful protest. He wanted all of the construction to end. Anyway, Ron yelled out, "Joy, can you please go and get Chuck and get him to come move his brat of a son?" And Chuck came down, still rubbing the sleep out of his eyes. He was wearing these slip-on moccasin things and he walked over towards Jupiter. As he did, his slipper caught on a bit of chain link fence that one of the construction workers had left on the ground, and he fell onto Jupiter. So in the blink of an eye, Jupiter, obviously startled, turned around, bit into Chuck's neck, made these four super, super deep puncture wounds in his neck, and then ripped him and threw him, which snapped his spine instantly. So he... all of a sudden just lashed out and ended Chuck's
life.
And
he's dead.
Yes.
Just snap.
Yep, gone. Well, he had a few more seconds of life because straight away Ron went to him and picked him up and he looked up into Ron's eyes and the only words he was able to get out were, "I love."
That's not true. Ron made that up. He could not. No. Yeah. Sorry, Ron, didn't happen of the year awards. You're a liar. His neck and whoop spine, no, he didn't say anything, but that's fine.
I'm with you on this. The other element of the story at this stage that Ron recounts is that Jupiter just suddenly had this look of regret on his face. He was just shocked at what he had done.
No, he didn't.
And he lay back down and just went and started spitting out the blood that he had in
his
mouth.
No, he didn't. Ron, bless you, but no, that is not true. Didn't happen of the year awards, first prize.
Anyway, Joy was the one who then called the police, of course, and then a few weeks later they buried Chuck's ashes in front of Jupiter's cage. And
don't rub it in his face. Oh, weirdos.
Well, they genuinely believe that, you know, Chuck loved Jupiter possibly more than he loved them. He loved Jupiter more than anything in the world, so they thought it's where he'd want to be.
Yeah, but what about what Jupiter wants?
Oh, Jupiter had no idea what was going on.
But that's what I'm saying. So just fucking leave him out of it. Put the ashes... Anyway, okay.
Anyway, so both obviously devastated. Joy in particular went into a deep, deep state of shock, whereas Ron believed that the show must go on. And the choice was given to them as to whether they would put Jupiter down or not. Obviously, they chose not to because this is a very, very, very valuable cat. And they'd convinced themselves that this was just a freak accident. It wasn't Jupiter's fault. It wasn't Jupiter's fault. I do agree with them on that.
No, of course it wasn't. Yeah. Yeah, of course it wasn't.
He'd been spooked by the construction going on around him and he acted on reflex because someone fell on him.
Well, and he's just an animal. He's a wild animal who's not meant to be in that kind of captivity.
Exactly.
Like, it's... yeah.
So,
but they can't ever admit that to themselves because that means having to reconcile the fact that their entire life is based on animal cruelty and they're never going to do that.
That's correct. So once again, we've got these characters who just keep doubling down on the bad choices that they're making. And so I do agree they shouldn't have put Jupiter down, but what they should have done, and every trainer in the world would agree with this, is isolate Jupiter. Because the rule of thumb is, if you kill one person, yes, that's a tragic accident. If you kill a second person, that is totally preventable, and that is on the humans, not on the animal.
Does he kill a second person?
he's coming back for more in just a couple of weeks, yes.
Uh-oh, tell me.
So Ron really wanted to get everything back to normal, but Joy had basically just had a nervous breakdown. She was staying in bed. Mm-hmm. She wouldn't shower. She wouldn't eat. She lost 10 kilos in about 5 weeks, so she was down to only 40 kilograms. She was very, very frail. Every time Ron would try to get her out of her room, she would refuse, and she was saying that all she wanted was to die. She was praying to God to end her life. She felt like she deserved it because of the fact that they were responsible for Chuck's death, but of course, because she was a Catholic, she couldn't commit suicide because that's a terrible sin. Ron was just determined he was going to get his wife back, and so he brought her best friend to come and stay with them, and also Chuck's best friend, and they all tried really hard to help her. They took her to a doctor who prescribed her muscle relaxants to help just calm her nerves. And home she went, and the doctor said, look, we're going to have to hospitalize her in a couple of days if things don't get better. So Ron was determined he was going to get Joy to come out and visit the babies because he thought that was the best step in her rehabilitation, come out and actually see the kids that miss you. And so out she came. She started playing with Shercon. Ron thought this was a really good sign, and he decided he'd get her to help with feeding Jupiter. And of course, when she came near Jupiter, she was carrying a Tupperware container of chicken necks. She started to shake vigorously. She's on a whole lot of muscle relaxants here. Toxicology reports indicate that she was secretly drinking a lot at this time as well. Plus, she had not been eating. So she was not in a good way. And when she started walking towards Jupiter, she started to stumble. Jupiter was on one of those flimsy leashes that Ron was holding at the time, and he jumped up and he completely ripped out Joy's neck, then picked her up and threw her in the air. So she was dead by the time she hit the ground.
Oh my God.
Again,
I did not see that coming. I did not think Joy was going to go.
Yep. And again, just in the blink of an eye, freak accident. What made this one different, according to Ron, is he believes that this was a very intentional kill as opposed to just an accident like what happened with Chuck. He saw the look in Jupiter's eyes, and he believes that cats apparently have this instinct where if a member of their pack is unwell or too old or vulnerable, they won't even think. They'll just kill them, because they need to do what they can to protect the group.
Yeah.
So he believes that it was a sort of natural instinct for Jupiter. But at the same time, he did realize, oh my God, Jupiter, you are inbred after all. I'm sure of it. You are inbred. Yeah.
And also, it's just like he's clearly a wild, dangerous animal who whose instincts they cannot control. And it has to be said that she probably had her period. No, I'm kidding. I couldn't even get to the end of that without laughing. No, but for real, as if it's anything to do. I think he was just pissed off. He was just like, get away from me. Stop this bullshit. Just, he wanted to kill things because he's angry and mentally ill. Like, it's like in Blackfish. They say after years and years of a life like that, Tillicum went insane.
Yeah. It makes sense. I mean, Jupiter was only 3 years old, but in those 3 years, all he had never known was being controlled by an animal that is lower down on the food chain than him. So I can definitely imagine that there would have been some resentment there for him. At any rate, instinct number one for Ron was to go and get his gun and shoot the animal and shoot himself, but his friend intervened and called the police instead. So the SWAT team showed up, and they waited and waited for 2 hours, hoping that Jupiter would just go back into his cage and then they could make a decision about what to do with him. But when it was clear that he wasn't going anywhere because he was just pacing back and forth in front of Joy's body. Meanwhile, all of the other cats around the park were just sitting or standing in their cages and staring at Joy's body as
Is so eerie. Oh, I got goosebumps just now.
Yeah, you can imagine the scene, blood everywhere, just absolutely horrific.
Do you think they're all looking like, yes, someone finally did it. Like, do you think that's why they're looking? Like, that's what you get.
Ron,
or were they like, oh, mum?
Yeah, Ron's belief is that they were mourning their mother. My belief is maybe
no
they
way.
Were just
I think
hungry.
They were rejoicing. Yeah, or they're just cats and they're just looking at a dead piece of meat.
Yep.
Yes, exactly.
Mm-hmm. We are Ooh, their prey.
That is, can you imagine seeing that in person? I can't even.
Yeah, horrendous. Ron says that when Jupiter ripped out Joy's neck, the blood splashed all over his face, and for the next few months he only saw red. The only colour that he could see when he opened his eyes was red.
That's some intense PTSD you'd have.
Yeah. Of course, they ended up shooting Jupiter and they did an autopsy, and of course it proved he was inbred, had been all along. Ron had just been ignoring all of the signs. Like I said before, they're unpredictable and they're difficult to train, but they just looked past all of those facts and chose to believe that he wasn't inbred.
What becomes of Ron? He's lost his two great loves. Plus now, really, he can't do cats any... Oh, just tell me, what becomes of Ron?
What becomes of Ron? All right, so he'd lost everyone and everything. He became a recluse for 6 months and he basically lost his mind in that time. His dream was completely dead and it had all happened within the space of 5 weeks, and it was all because of his negligence and his ego and his vanity.
Hubris.
And I don't know how much he actually acknowledged this consciously, but it all came down to him. And he did fall into a very, very deep depression, made worse by the fact that the only people who were contacting him were people who wanted to offer to buy his remaining cats because they wanted to hunt them. He was determined that he was going to keep the animals and do everything that he could to protect them. They were his reason to live. Yeah. But he had to sell the ranch because he'd lost his income and he was spending $40,000 a month just on food for the cats.
Yeah.
So he had to find somewhere that he could go. And he was approached by a company called Amazing Exotics. And they're a nonprofit education center in Florida. And they offered him a job and a home for the cats. So he took five of the cats. Unfortunately, they couldn't take all of them. So some of the cats did have to be put down. And Ron became an animal behaviorist, which meant that he was basically teaching people how to be a tiger trainer. And he's got a very...
Excuse me. How is... is he not the least qualified person? I feel like... I'm more qualified to do that than him at this stage.
It's so funny because his teaching style is very unconventional. There's a documentary that shows a lot of him in the classroom, and it is pretty much just him telling lurid stories about his sex life and showing home videos, a lot of which are of him and Joy dancing. And he claims
but
that
how
he's...
How is that? That is like me saying, okay... I can teach you to do heart surgery because I've done it twice and both times I fucked it up royally, but I've done it. So have any of you done it? No. Who's the most qualified person in the room? Me. Like that is some bottom of the barrel bullshit.
Yeah, it's very questionable, but I'm glad that it did happen and he got that job because one of his students, a guy called Adam, had a brother called Harris, and Harris was a documentary filmmaker. So Harris decided, oh, I need to tell this story. And so he approached Ron and said, let's make a movie of this. It took them almost 8 years to go through all of the home video footage. There was more than 160 hours of footage that these narcissistic people took of themselves and each other. There was also lots of media coverage and on-camera interviews to go through, and they pieced together this story, which is predominantly Ron explaining everything. He is the narrator of the documentary. Yeah. It's called Cat Dancers, and it was released in 2007. It was nominated for a few different awards. Ron traveled around to go to some of the premieres because this was his chance to be back in the spotlight once again.
Would have loved it.
He is a consummate performer and you can really see it in the documentary. He speaks like he's a really candid, open person, and he shows a lot of behind the scenes stuff, like him putting on his wig tape in the morning and brushing his dog's teeth and stuff. So he's, you know, making it seem like everything is very honest and open, but it all does feel very, very performative because he's been a performer his entire life. Yeah. And he's told these stories a million times to his students, so it all sounds very rehearsed. And like you said, this is all his side of the story, and he can tell us whatever details he wants us to hear and whatever details he comes up with in his imagination, like the I love... moment. But he was very happy.
Well, he's the only one left, so he can write the narrative now.
That's right.
He's in control.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He was very happy with the documentary. It was very sympathetic towards him. The only thing that they sort of disagreed about was Ron is adamant that Joy was not trying to commit suicide when she went out there with Jupiter, whereas Harris, the filmmaker, does believe that she wanted to end her life, and so that's why she made the choice
suicide
that she made to go out
by
there.
By inbred white tiger.
That's right, yeah.
That's a way to go, isn't it?
Yeah.
I don't think that's true. Do you think that's what she did?
I kind of do, just because when you read interviews with Harris Fishman and he talks about the different evidence to indicate, because of all the different things that she'd said and things that he had seen on some of their home video footage, he seems really, really certain that this was her way of ending it all without being sent to hell for committing suicide.
Of course, of course. So it couldn't be... Okay, yeah, well, that makes me think it's more possible then. Yes, because I've heard Catholic people doing things like that so that they set it up so that they will die, but they're not the one who does it.
That's right.
You know, just kind of a little loophole around that little sin there, around that little rule. Okay, yeah, maybe. And if she was off her face and on all who knows what kind of drugs she'd been given and mixed that with booze and mixed that with... profound grief. She could have just, not in her right mind.
Yeah. So that was the only thing that they sort of disagreed on. Apart from that, Ron found the whole process to be very cathartic and he felt like he could move on with his life from this point.
Yeah.
At the end of the documentary, he vowed that he was going to sell everything and pack up and move to a monastery in Thailand when he turned 80, where he could live peacefully amongst the tigers and wildlife that they have there in this monastery.
He's then, definitely the kind of person they want around their animals.
Yeah. and then at the very end of the documentary, we learned that Amazing Exotics had to close down in 2007 just before the documentary came out. And at that time, Ron only had two of his cats left alive and they had to be put down, which meant that he really and truly was the last member of their family left alive once all of this was said and done. Very sad.
Well, it didn't sound like Amazing Exotics was... You know, what did they call themselves? An education?
Not-for-profit education centre, yes.
Yep. Yes. No, they weren't. They were just another dodgy animal park. And so they were just like Carole Baskin. They were just like Joe Exotic.
Would you like to guess how and why Amazing Exotics was shut down?
Carole Baskin.
That goddamn bitch, Carole Baskin.
That goddamn bitch, Carole Baskin. She got it shut down.
Yep. Big Cat Rescue was lobbying the USDA and Florida's Wildlife Conservation Commission to get them to shut down this park because they were.
Why didn't she take all the tigers then? Why didn't she take all the cats?
Good question. I do not know the answer to that. I mean, she's got limited facilities.
So much of her activism is performative because she would rather get this place shut down and have all the animals killed, like then like take the time to rehome them. It might take you a bit longer and you might not get to stand on your high horse outside of Capitol Hill and say you've got this victory. But like, bureaucracy isn't sexy. It takes a while. It takes longer to do things. It's boring. But she could have found... proper homes for all those cats. Instead, she just... Oh, she's full of shit. I hate her. I'm sorry, but she would rather feel like a hero for shutting down a park and let all those cats die. then take the time to find homes for them.
I mean, I do not know. I could not find a record of what happened to all of those animals, but it was more than just cats. I mean, they had... It was like a Noah's Ark. They had everything from chimpanzees to camels to warthogs, like two of everything at least. So I don't know what became of them. But yes, you're absolutely right. Shutting it down probably wasn't just the smartest, best solution. It was just the fastest and most dramatic.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Damn Carol Baskin.
She released a statement saying that she was not going to watch cat dances. She said it was going to be nothing but a fluff piece and she had no compassion for Ron or for Joy. 2010, there was another episode of a documentary series on Animal Planet that's called Fatal Attractions. That was dedicated to telling the Ron and Joy story. I'm going to post a link to that if you want to see additional details. And that has some fantastic reenactments.
I wish it was called Fatal Attractions. Oh, I love a good reenactment. Awesome. Mm.
And that is where we learned that at that time, because Amazing Exotics had shut down, Ron had returned to his first love, which was dance. He's a ballet dance instructor at a place called Dance Dynamics.
I mean, not all. He sounds like a monster, but okay.
Yeah. Here's one of the weirdest facts that I found, and I only found evidence of this on his Pinterest and then on some, like, legal US websites. In 2015, he adopted a 26-year-old man from Egypt called Shalom Joseph as his son.
Well, that was common back then. Before gay marriage was made legal in the US, older men would adopt their partners as a way that meant they were legally each other's next of kin, legally family.
Okay,
I'd say that was his case. Egyptian lover.
Yes.
Yeah.
Whether they're still together today, I have no idea, but I do know that Ron is still alive at 84 years old, out there somewhere.
84, wowzers.
Mm. Yep.
What a story.
It's quite a saga, and I think you'd agree that the moral here is don't f*** with wild animals and don't support any businesses that do exploit animals in any way. It's cruel and it's dangerous.
Yeah. Seriously, like making wild animals perform tricks for you, it never pays off. Mm-hmm. It just doesn't. You know how they say crime doesn't pay?
Yeah.
Making animals do tricks doesn't pay.
Have I ever told you the story of when I went to the Moulin Rouge in Paris?
No.
This was in like 2011. I had no idea that they use live animals in their shows on the stage at Moulin Rouge.
Do they?
Yeah. Shetland ponies, giant pythons, leopards, so many different animals, and they all just look terrified. They even had a poodle, and this guy was pulling on a string to make its lower jaw go up and down it was a puppet. It was disgusting, and so I demanded my money back, and they, of course, refused in their French accent, and they were like, we have been sold out every single day since 2000 and blah, blah, blah. And I was like, yeah, of course, because everyone is coming here expecting it's going to be Nicole Kidman and Can-Can dancers ever since the movie came out. No one's expecting animal cruelty. They refused to give me my money back, so I just grabbed two bottles of champagne and stormed out.
And legged it. I love how I'm sitting here going all on my high horse. It's not fair. It's really mean. That's so awful. And I'm like totally about to go have like a massive beef burger for lunch. So. But, you know. Wow. Well, I just, bloody hell.
Mm-hmm.
I guess if we've learned one thing in this whole epic tale, that was excellent, by the way, it's that if you're going to be around big cats and you're a lady, you better not have your period. That, big cats and vampires.
On that note.
Be careful. Well, we give you just the gist. If you want more, we'll put all of Jacob's little linkies in the show notes. Follow Just the Gist podcast on Instagram. I remember to post in it quite frequently now, so there's things on there. Follow Jacob William Stanley on Instagram because he's posting stuff now. And I did notice some people are still demanding your skincare routine, so can you please hurry up and influence that shiz up and put that stuff up? Mm-hmm. Follow me, Rosie Waterland. Please email us. We love your emails. justthegistpodcast@gmail.com. I think that's all we have to say.
See you next week.
See you next week. Love you. Bye. Love you.
Bye. Listener.